Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Hello. From the studios of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Byron Scott, your host for this week's discussion of world news events by professionals whose job it is to report the facts and analyze the consequences. First, a confession. My own knowledge of popular music seems to have peaked about the time Dr. Hook and the Medicine Show recorded the cover of the Rolling Stone. That 1973 hit, by the way, was re-recorded and for UK release as the cover of the Radio Times, in order to get playtime on the BBC's network. While happily the Rolling Stone magazine still exists, a number of others have gone under. The world of pop music reporting has changed dramatically. Digital downloads, copyright battles, and of course the internet have dramatically changed the industry. If video killed the radio star, as Britain's The Buggles insisted in 1979, what was the World Wide Web done to the music industry and the way it's covered? Here to give us their views on how music journalism is reshaping itself today are Stephen Thompson, editor and reviewer for NPR Music, who was founding editor of The Onion's entertainment section and whose freelance articles are often seen in The Washington Post and London's Guardian, among others. Maura Johnston, music editor of The Village Voice, who's also the founding editor of the music blog Idolater and frequent NPR contributor. And Simon Vozek-Levinson, associate editor at NPR's Rolling Stone magazine, whose work also appears in Entertainment Weekly and the Boston Phoenix. That's about as hip an intro as I'm capable of doing, Stephen. Can you help us out with a little background on music journalism, where it's coming from, and introduce the topic of where it might be going?
Well, I mean, it's a huge topic. I mean, when I first took an interest in sort of writing about music, you know, it was probably the late 1980s, you know, and the beginning of the 90s, and to me, the absolute be-all and end-all of music journalism was, you know, the handful of magazines that I had, you know, coming into my house. You know, I was a hardcore Rolling Stone subscriber. You know, I like to consider myself the youngest Billboard magazine subscriber ever. When I was 14, my parents got me a subscription, and you know, to me, the like I said, the absolute be all and end all was this handful of magazines. And now, over time, particularly as a result of, you know, the encroachment of the internet, it has, you know, that has really spread out, you know, well beyond this sort of core group of magazines. Now, the magazines that have survived, I think, can emerge stronger, provided that they're you know, willing to adapt and be, you know, sort of as agile as possible. But, you know, it's forever changed. I mean, the lesson of the internet is that you don't get to, you know, whether you are a musician yourself or somebody who writes about music, you don't really get to control how people consume your content. And so, you know, we've seen in recent years a lot of print publications, you know, sort of drying up and blowing away, sadly. You know, magazines that I've really liked, like Blender and Vibe, you know, that have gone away completely, you know, and others that are struggling to sell ad pages. And, you know, and sort of that world of, like, you know, individual monolithic organizations, you know, that everyone is, you know, that are sort of the be-all and end-all of music journalism, you know, are sort of, you know, still learning how to adapt in this new marketplace.
Simon Vozek-Levinson, as an editor of The Survivor, Rolling Stone magazine, what do you feel about this perspective?
Right. Well, everything that Stephen said, I think, is pretty much accurate. That's pretty much the way it's gone. And I think to sort of return to something that you touched on, the key for, you know, longstanding print publications that are, you know, trying to survive and thrive in the current climate is adapting and being smart about adapting. It's, you know, the key is being able to have a sort of robust web presence that stays true to, you know, the goals and mission of a print publication. And, you know, when that happens, you can actually, you know, really, it can be a really great thing for a publication instead of, you know, being something to fear or worry about.
Mara Johnston, can the print and digital forms of music journalism live together?
Well, you know, for my job, actually, I have responsibilities that hybridize the sort of print and online sections of The Voice. All the editors in the Village Voice media chain are responsible for running, you know, frequently updated, I would say, 8 to 10 times a day music blogs, and also for sort of expanding certain aspects of their coverage and going longer in the print sections of those papers. And, you know, it's still pretty interesting to see the sort of divide in what works online and what works in print. There's always the truism that was probably started by, you know, magazines, well, years ago, that lists are really popular. And I mean, I do think that with putting content online, you sort of have to hustle it a little bit more. Like, you can't just be the person coming down from the mountaintops with the tablets and saying, this record is good, you should listen to it. You sort of have to get the audience's attention, which is something that, you know, print publications didn't really have to worry about. Like, if you were getting a subscription to Spin in the mail or a subscription to Paste in the mail, you would leaf through, you know, maybe not every single page, but you would look at the issue as a whole. And with internet content, it becomes a lot more sort of picking your spots, where, you know, if you read, say, the Village Voice music blog Sound in the City, you don't necessarily have to click on every link to get a taste of it. You can just follow a link from Twitter, you can follow a link from Facebook, you can follow a link a friend sent you. So it is, you know, it is sort of this interesting survival method, because obviously with online advertising models, it's a lot more, you know, you need as many readers as possible to see your content, because the monetization is just so skewed compared to print advertising models. And so you really do, like, have to make these sort of mercenary decisions. And I think that that's actually kind of bad for the business as a whole, just because I think that it, you know, squashes sort of, like, creativity on the parts of writers. And, you know, if you're always putting the Google Trends or Twitter Trends first, you're not. You might miss out on something that might be adventurous.
Let me ask our panelists then. How has this changed the job of the music journalist? In my years of teaching, I used to get all sorts of students coming in and saying, "Boy, music journalism is the most." Glamorous job possible. You get to hang out with the bands, you know, you get to travel from city to city. It's like going to a concert every night, you know, and that's what I want to be. And of course, very, very few of them got there. What is the life of a music journalist today, Stephen?
Well, it is. I mean, it's funny, like, working within NPR, you know, there's a little bit of a mentality around the building that, like, the NPR music wing of the building is sort of, oh, that's the cool kids. You know, we have concerts in our offices, you know, quite a bit, and sort of like, oh, that's where the, you know, I drive a 2004 Chrysler Town and Country. I'm a divorced dad in his late 30s. We're not the cool kids at all. It's a lot of, you know, sifting through piles and piles of CDs. Now, I mean, at the same time, it beats working in the mines. You know, I love doing this, and, you know, I would, you know, this is what I've really always wanted to do with my life. But it's not necessarily, you know, it's not necessarily massively glamorous. At the same time, you know, it's you know, if you love music, and if you consider yourself sort of a music geek, and you have, you know, during the course of your job, the opportunity to interact with people who produce art that you love, you know, that's certainly, you know, that's you know, that's certainly exciting. There's still an element, you know, I like to say that, you know, when I open my mail, you know, and I'm opening like a giant stack of padded envelopes with CDs in them, it still feels a little bit like Christmas morning, you know, and I don't ever want to let go of that excitement, you know, of you know, discovering a new record that I love, or just opening the mail and it's, hey, it's a new album by a band I love, you know. And if you lose that sense of love and discovery, you know, I feel like you're not going to be able to do the job as effectively.
I didn't hear you say a lot about hanging out with the band backstage. what about that? Do any of you do any of that? Or is that pretty much?
I've done a fair amount of that over the years.
Not, you know, the whole Almost Famous thing. I mean, I think especially, you know, even though there are so many, you know, acts on a sort of smaller non-major label scale now, they also have more media outlets to talk to and deal with. So, you know, it's like the days of riding the bus for a week and getting the real story are not existent anymore. I mean, I'll hear from artists sometimes. They'll be appreciative if I write about them. One thing that's been interesting actually is that, and I don't know if this happens to you, Simon and Steven, but artists or, you know, who are on social networking services are actually really solicitous about mentions and praise, and you know, they're very into retweeting or reposting things that have been written about them to sort of like amplify to their fans what's going on, you know, in the sort of greater discourse about them.
Well,
that's I think the way that most interactions go now, I think.
Well, one thing I think we can't lose sight of in this conversation is that as much as the business of trying to survive as a music journalist has changed, so has the business of trying to survive as a musician. And there's more sort of day-to-day ground level hustle involved in making a living as a musician than ever before. And so, you know, absolutely, that, you know, a lot of the interactions that we as music journalists have with musicians nowadays, and Simon, you know, can back me up or dispute this, you know, there's a lot more, you know, almost like you're almost collaborating with at least the smaller stars. I mean, I'm not out there touring with Beyonce, but you know, we have bands come in and they perform at our office, and there's a lot of sort of like, well, here, let me help carry your gear because you're coming up and performing in our office. There's not, to me, like, nothing demystifies musicians like spending time with musicians.
Hang on just a second here. I have to do our mid-show insert here, and then we'll go to Simon. Before we continue this live discussion, I want to remind our audience that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcast at globaljournalist.org, and you'll also be interested in the articles, online discussions, and other features that are part of the Global Journalist website. You also can send us questions or comments, care of Global Journalist Program, oneword@gmail.com, or simply look us up on Facebook. See, we are a little connected here. Simon, the life of the Rolling Stone journalist today.
Right. Well, you know, I'm not sure that, you know, being a music journalist at a big magazine was ever quite as glamorous as it's been portrayed in popular culture. And personally, I entered the business, I think, after what, you know, many would consider the glory years of that kind of life. But, you know, I try not to be jaded. I think there is still, you know, something pretty special about, you know, working in a job where, you know, you make your living by, you know, talking to creative people, thinking about creative work. And interacting with you know, with artists that way, I think there's something very rewarding about that. Maura mentioned the way that artists, you know, are sort of present on the internet and social media, and the way that, you know, that gives artists a chance to sort of interact directly with critics. That can be terrifying at times. I remember at my last job an incident where I wrote a blog post about Justin Bieber's first week album sales, in which I suggested that maybe he had not sold as many copies as his label would have liked. And he went on Twitter and, you know, went on sort of a rant saying, you know, why would an adult rain on a 16-year-old's parade? How can he be so mean? And then I got a lot of very angry tweets from Justin Bieber's fans. So that was a slightly scary experience. But, you know, I think in the long run, I think that kind of direct engagement is a good thing, and you know, it can be scary. But I think it's, you know, I think the more engagement that critics are forced to have with the artists they cover, I think probably the better it is for music journalism as a whole.
It's okay though if the rants are limited to 140 characters.
You'd be surprised how they can add.
It's not quite as bad as it might be.
Fanatical fans, but yeah.
Is there I recall I used to always look at Rolling Stone for people like Tom Wolfe and Hunter S. Thompson, who also added the social issues and around the band, and which leads to the question: is Rolling Stone really a music magazine, or is it a popular culture magazine?
Well, our mission statement has always been to cover not only the music, but the culture around the music. And that's been true since, you know, Rolling Stone was founded over 40 years ago. And I think that continues to be true. We still cover music in depth. You know, that's still a very major part of our mission, you know, along with other things that we cover, like national affairs and other parts of pop culture. But, you know, yeah, covering music is still definitely a thriving part of what goes on here, for sure.
I mean, I would add
to that. Yeah, go ahead.
In terms of Rolling Stone, though, that a very important part of that magazine's, you know, survival and ability to continue thriving is that it has this very, very, very strong editorial voice that is not just music related. The fact that they have a very, very strong political writer who has an instantly recognizable voice that gives that magazine a bit of a jolt of electricity, I think, is very, very important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, thanks, Stephen. I think that's correct. And actually, I think you could say some more things about both of your publications, you know, NPR and The Village Voice. I think all three of us work for places where, you know, you have very strong music coverage, but it's, you know, it's being anchored by, you know, other you know, things, political coverage, other kinds of coverage.
What about that, Mara?
Elsewhere?
Oh, I you know, and I think it's also a good thing because it brings sort of non-obsessives about music into the fold.
Mm-hmm.
And so they might, you know, wind up discovering something that is unexpected. I mean, when I was at Idolator, which was part of the Gawker media empire when it first launched, you know, one of the things that would always sort of be a boon for us was just having the other sites in the network to sort of link off. And, you know, if we were doing a post that was, you know, on, say, baseball at bat songs, which is sort of a pet topic of mine, we would, you know, link it from Deadspin. I mean, that's one thing that I think is really interesting about just music coverage and how it gets and how new music gets out to the public in general is how, you know, how crucial the idea that there is this sort of other anchor, whether it's the political coverage in Rolling Stone or just, you know, having an hour-long program on NPR that has a short music segment. It really, you know, it has become sort of a thing where people still love music, but they might have other things in their life that they, you know, have to pay attention to as well. So, you know, it's good to sort of get the music in there. It's like, eat your vegetables and we'll give you dessert or something.
Which are the vegetables and which are the desserts?
That's a personal question for everyone, I guess.
Stephen, what about that at NPR?
Well, I think Maura brings up a great point that you know, having a more general audience, having an audience that does not always speak the somewhat insular language of the music writer, I think has been a very valuable very valuable to me and to the people here at NPR Music, is that, you know, when you are sort of forced to reassess, you know, you're not just doing a brain dump where you're speaking your own language and that's good enough. You know, if you have to adapt the language that you're speaking to a more general audience, that and still respect that audience, you know, that's going to make you a better writer and a better critic and a better evaluator of music. The fact that you know, I have, you know, it's one thing if I write an essay for one of our music blogs or appear on our music discussion show, All Songs Considered. You know, maybe I can speak a more insular language, but, you know, I was on Morning Edition yesterday talking about the band Noah and the Whale, and there was a certain amount of, you know, as I was going back and forth with my editors, you know, there's this real discussion. Well, does our audience know what that means? Does, you know, and sort of taking your writing and running it through a filter of, you know, making of really thinking about who your audience is, I think that that's always going to make you a better writer.
Definitely. Well, what's the old cliche about the rock critic? You know, it's sort of like the same cliche about the record store clerk who's just, you know, speaking in tongues and looking down on you while they do so. I mean, that's the sort of music writing that I think audiences get turned off by and, you know, have different shorthands for describing it, whether it's, you know, a certain critic's name or a certain publication. But I really do think that, you know, music is something that everyone, I think, I don't think it's too much of a generalization to say that everybody loves it in some form. And so to sort of bring people together in whatever way, I think it's something that's really powerful and special.
There seemed to be a certain amount of discussion about music journalism not only changing, but having its very life imperiled. This doesn't sound like the way you all are talking. It sounds like still a pretty exciting way to go. Simon Vozick Levinson, what about that? Is this metamorphosis or a death approaching?
Yeah, you know, I think the death of music journalism has been greatly exaggerated. It's certainly true that, you know, over the past 10 years or so, the internet has forced music journalism to change in certain substantial ways, and, you know, not exclusively good ways, but, you know, I think in the long run, it's certainly more of a metamorphosis than a death. I think that, you know, people's appetite for writing and reading about music isn't going anywhere anytime in the near future. So the industry may be changing, but you know, music journalism will live in one form or another, I would say, for the foreseeable future.
But the audiences seem to be coming at it in different ways. Mara, you seem to be saying that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, definitely, you know, I mean, just the whole idea that now with social media, there are so many artists who are sort of putting their own narratives forward. That's, you know, that's definitely one thing. And I do think also people are coming at it, you know, just from not getting, I mean, you know, people have more entertainment options, so they might be more distracted than they were 10, 20 years ago. But I do think that, you know, definitely the morph of music journalism from these sort of like magazines to this sort of large group music blogs, which we haven't even really touched on yet, is sort of, you know, the amateur or the amateur gone professional music blogs that are out there, like Stereogum or, you know, even Pitchfork, which started off as a sort of a basement project, and now it's this, you know, titan with its own festivals and this very recognizable brand. So there are definitely different ways for people to get to this writing, and I think that it's still something that can unite people. I guess one thing that everybody's sort of thinking about is just, you know, how can it be also a sustainable business at the same time?
Steven, say something about that. Changes in journalism.
Sorry, if I could,
the music side.
I have to run to a meeting, so I think I'm going to have to leave in about 2 minutes.
Sure.
If that's all right.
That's fine. And did you, Simon, want to say something just before? We're coming down to the tail end of the show.
Sure. Well, I think the observation Maura just made about publications like, you know, Pitchfork that started as sort of these sort of independent labors of love and have now grown into really substantial forces. I think that's an interesting story, but not necessarily a new story. I mean, I think if you look back at the history of Rolling Stone, we also started on a much smaller level before, you know, becoming a major magazine. And I think that when you take the long view, that's, you know, maybe a hopeful sign for the future that, you know, even as the industry changes, there's still an opportunity for, you know, new brands to establish themselves and, you know, new outlets to really make a name.
Thank you, Simon. And, good luck at your meeting. I see all journalists have to go to meetings.
Yeah, sadly.
Stephen Thompson, I'm going to give you the final word here about the future of music journalism, and say a couple of things about blogs as well, if you would.
Sure, absolutely. I think Simon and Maura are both are both totally right that there is still room for. There's still a lot of room, I think, for new voices to emerge, both within existing organizations and in terms of new labors of love, like a Pitchfork, like a Stereogum. You know, I think one of the big lessons that I've sort of picked up on from the last decade or two of sort of massive change in the world of music journalism is just how much more demanding, sort of for better and for worse, the audience is. That you know, the audience is not tired of music writing. The audience is not tired of these publications. You know, now of course, as more sort of brush past the notion of business models, and thankfully Maura and Simon and I don't have to worry too much about the mechanics of that. But you know, the fact that the audience is sort of hungrier than ever, you know, is exciting. It, it presents sort of an opportunity for the continued survival of music journalism. But at the same time, you know, we all have to really be listening for that. I mean, the fact of the matter is, we just did at NPR Music a concert by Bon Iver, you know, at the 9:30 Club in Washington D.C. We streamed this beautiful audio of it, and you know, we set up a chat room on the page, so fans of the band could get together and listen.
About
and talk.
Five more seconds, Stephen.
Oh, sorry. And everybody was listening was like, well, where's our video?
Right.
So, you know, as you go forward, you know, you sort of have to constantly be willing to offer more, even as you're potentially being paid less.
And that's another show. I want to thank our guests, Stephen Thompson of NPR Music, Simon Vozick-Levinson of Rolling Stone Magazine, and Maura Johnston from The Village Voice. Our lead producer for this show is David Cawthon. Our director is Andrew Orozco. This is Andrew's last show with us, and we thank him for a great summer. Audio by Pat Akers. Other global journalist producers include Liz Lance and Jessica Popovec. Our video producer is Tim Wall, who did today's visuals before leaving for Honduras. This is Byron Scott for Global Journalists, reminding you that you can download, view, or listen to this show, plus additional features, by going to globaljournalist.org. Join us next week as journalists open their journals to put you inside their stories. And now, stay tuned for the latest edition of Free Press Watch.
And now, Global Journalists Free Press Watch, where each week we bring you a roundup of major events in press freedom around the world. I'm Jessica Popovac. This week's reports come from Reporters Without Borders. First, let's go to the nation of Somalia, where last week ongoing violence claimed the life of radio broadcaster Farah Hassan Sahal. Sahal was shot outside of Mogadishu's Radio Simba headquarters. Observers say he was killed by government troops. Radio Simba recently suspended operations due to ongoing clashes in Somalia between a Muslim militia group and the government. Farah Hassan Sahal had worked for Radio Simba ever since its creation in 2006. He was 45. And in Turkey, a much-anticipated plan to install a new tiered internet filtering system is being pared down and postponed. The new system, as previously described, would have been controlled exclusively by a government council with little, if any, transparency. The new plans have yet to be outlined. Nonetheless, opponents of government censorship this week are calling the suspension a victory. And good news in the Chinese media world emerged this week. Blogger Ran Yunfei was released after nearly 7 months in prison. He will remain under house arrest for the next 6 months, during which time he will be forbidden to express himself publicly. Yunfei was arrested along with several other so-called cyber dissidents during the uprisings that swept China earlier this year. He was charged with inciting subversion of state authority. At least four of his fellow bloggers arrested during the same crackdown remain behind bars. As always, you can find links to more information on these and other stories on our website at www.globaljournalist.org. From everyone here at Global Journalist Radio, thank you for joining us.